Good afternoon. You're in tune with KTOO FM. It's just exactly 3 o'clock, and I'm Pat Moore, hosting Juno Afternoon today. We'll be talking today with Jen Hoffman about a video, The Eskimo and the Whale, which will show Wednesday night at 8 on 360 North TV. Discovery Southeast will have folks in to tell us about the Early Dismissal Monday program. Colette Costa and Cheryl Levitt will be here. They'll preview Wednesday's Windy Ridge Roundup. And Michaela Moore will be here with a preview of the upcoming high school production of The Curious Savage. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more today on Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast, periods of rain, highs around 50, light winds becoming east 10 miles per hour in the afternoon.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, an Ontario First Nation received support from the Assembly of First Nations, a national organization representing First Nations across the country. A delegation from the Shoal Lake First Nation began a walk Monday to raise awareness and support for their rights to water in their traditional territory. Participants will travel nearly 200 miles from their Ontario community to Winnipeg, Manitoba. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo expressed his support. Atleo says for more than a century, the province of Manitoba and the city of Winnipeg have been granted free access to fresh water from the First Nation territory without proper discussion or compensation. The walk is expected to last 4 days. The Public Utilities Commission is seeking comment from people in Nevada about the Reed Gardner coal-fired power plant. The Moapa Paiute tribe is located near the plant. The tribe has concerns about related health issues like respiratory illnesses. And, as Mike Clifford reports, an environmental organization is concerned about a new lease through 2023.
According to Vinnie Spottleson of the Sierra Club, keeping the nation's old plants like Reed Gardner running will cost ratepayers hundreds of millions of dollars in new pollution controls. He says once you tack on the cost of out-of-state coal and the price of hazardous waste control, it adds up to a bad deal for Nevada's environment and economy.
We're talking hundreds of million, if not over $1 billion that we could look at spending on this coal plant over the next 12 years, or that we could spend on clean energy here in Nevada and create the jobs of the future.
NV Energy says coal costs less for consumers, and if older coal plants go offline, there would be a need for new, more expensive natural gas plants. Spottleson disagrees. He says there's enough geothermal coming online in Nevada to counter most of what would be lost in phasing out Reed Gardner.
That was Mike Clifford reporting. A California tribe receives more than $3 million from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The department announced Monday the Yurok tribe was awarded the money to establish a veteran cemetery in Humboldt County. According to the VA, this is one of the first veteran cemetery awards to a tribal government. Construction will include 171 standard burial grave sites and 161 cremation grave sites. The new cemetery will serve the nearly 3,000 veterans of the tribe and their families. The closest national cemetery with available burial space is 175 miles away, and the nearest state veteran cemetery is also more than 100 miles away. Next Monday is Native American Day in South Dakota. Officials with a yet-to-be-completed monument in the western part of the state are planning a ceremony to honor the state's 9 tribes. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The South Dakota legislature created Native American Day in 1990. It's held the same day as Columbus Day every year and is meant to honor the contributions of Native Americans in the state. South Dakota's population is roughly 8% Native. Next Monday, officials with the Crazy Horse Monument in western South Dakota plan a day-long celebration. The program features Rosebud Sioux Tribal Police Chief Grace Her Many Horses, who is also a champion powwow dancer. Her Many Horses is one of 2 women in the state running tribal police departments. Officials also plan education activities for children and a free lunch of buffalo stew. If weather permits, there will be a blast on the mountain carving. Admission is free with a donation of 3 cans of food per person. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
During this month in 1962, the Institute of American Indian Arts opened in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The Fine Arts College offers 4-year degrees in studio arts, new media arts, creative writing, museum studies, and indigenous liberal studies. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kowanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you could get a payment of up to $50,000 or more. There will be meetings in locations around the country between July and December 2011 where you can get free legal help filing a claim. More details and a full schedule of meetings is available at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes after three. My first guest today is a filmmaker named Jen. And Jen is calling in to us today from Bend, Oregon. I'm hoping you're with me, Jen. Are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Oh, marvelous. The technology works. So, Jen Hoffman, you made this film in 2005, and one wonders, I guess it's a great pickup line in a bar, but what was a nice girl like you doing in Barrow at the time?
I'm a big traveler and had landed in Alaska after college in Southeast Alaska, and you kind of, as an outsider, forget how big the state is and the different cultures that are there, and I was completely intrigued with the Inuit, the Inupiaq, and whaling, and decided to explore it further. And I got a small travel grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum, and made my way up to Barrow. And it took me a better part of a year of traveling back and forth and gaining the trust of the community and the whalers, and that was the beginning of the adventure of making the Eskimo and the whale.
Well, I think people may be wondering why we're talking about this, and the reason is because it's going to air Wednesday night, October 5th, tomorrow night, on 360 North at 8 p.m., so it's a timely thing. That's the premiere broadcast. Then we're going to repeat the film again Sunday, October 9th, this coming Sunday evening at 7 p.m., so folks in Juneau will have a chance to see this and around the state. 360 North broadcast to, it's probably the most widely distributed television channel in Alaska. So that's why we're talking about the film. So you were in Barrow shooting the film, and it looked to, I watched the film. I got a preview copy of it and managed to sneak time in to watch it. You seemed to get an incredible degree of openness and cooperation from the Native community in Barrow. How did you achieve that?
I was very fortunate and worked with some fantastic people and families. And one, of course, which is one of the main characters in the film, John Nissingen and his father, Percy, I was invited on their whaling crew. And John was really my tour guide, my right hand for 3 years. And it was a difficult film to shoot in many ways and in many aspects. We had to spend, if you didn't get the shot that spring, you had to go up the next spring. And so we spent roughly, I spent three whaling seasons up in Barrow, working with the people and the community, and a lot of communication, a lot of trust, and they were very happy with the film, and everyone was very, very happy with it, and it worked out. I was very fortunate to work with such a great group of people in the community.
Now, the whaling season is not exactly high summer. What months were you up there shooting?
I was up there March, April, May, and back then, before, you know, the ice has changed drastically, we could shoot till early June. But predominantly we were shooting April and May, living in a canvas tent for about 6 weeks out on the ice, which was interesting, I think about 12 men and myself. Eating muktuk and various adventurous foods, and you know, you film, of course, it's light pretty much most of the time, so just filming around the clock, and a lot of polar bears, a lot of scary moments, and I'm just so impressed with with the whaling captains and how intuitive they are with nature and just the way of life up there. It's fascinating. And it really comes through, I think, in this film.
It really does. Part of what I was impressed with, there's one wonderful scene in the film where it's clear to me that you've connected so well with them and they're so ready to accept you that they actually briefly put you in charge of security at the whaling camp. You looked somewhat startled to be handed a .30-06 and told to stand by.
Petrified was a good one. I think they picked the rustiest gun with the rustiest bullets, and there were a lot of polar bears that year, and they just nonchalantly gave my crew and I this huge gun. But they did have, they always had a guard that was up 24 hours a day watching camp and watching for polar bears. So I felt pretty confident I wouldn't have to use that gun. And didn't have to.
How big was the crew, your crew?
We had, it varied per trip, sometimes up to four people. A lot of times it was two or three where I would run, and my main camera guy and I would run sound and B-roll, B-camera. Just the cost was enormous in and of itself, and to stay up there. We got a lot of in-kind services from the community, which really made the film possible. So, but my cameraman, John Chester, was up there pretty much the entire time with me over off and on a three-year period. So it varied, but up to four people.
Jen, one of the undercurrents that runs all the way through the movie was the ongoing meeting of the International Whaling Commission, and eventually in the film, first of all, the decision to actually ban subsistence whaling for a period of time, and then there's a postscript that talks about what happened after that. I guess my question is, in 2005 when you were up there, how widely was that followed by the people in Barrow?
Oh, it was devastating. The entire community lives for whaling. In fact, the ten communities that are involved with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, they subsist off the whale year round, and it was so saddening. I mean, there were real tears. There was lack of hope. But there was also hope that they would. The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and our representatives would come through, and in the end they did. But there was a time when it was stopped, and I don't know how really communities on the North Slope would make it through winters without whaling and subsistence whaling.
One of the things that really comes through visually and part of the audio track and everything else is the incredible amount of work that has to be performed here. A bowhead whale is a significant size, and this is done by people using largely hand implements. They tow with motorized boats and snow machines, but the majority of the actual work on the whale is done with hand tools.
It's a bit, there's definitely an urgency once the whale is brought up by hand, you know, manually onto the ice. Literally the VHF radios crackle and come alive, and you'll have up to 100 people that snow machine up to 13 miles out on the ice and with their sleds, and they have to work pretty fast before, you know, the ice melts and the whale will literally fall through. In the film, I believe it's a 57-foot bowhead they caught, and it took about 23-plus hours with about 70 people carving and hauling, making trips into Barrow and hauling in the meat. And the best parts of the whale are saved for the whaling festival in the Wakatuck, and in the film, that's interesting time. It's a beautiful time for the community, and interesting in the foods that they eat, and which I think the audience will enjoy.
So what other projects are you working on?
Working on one, I've been out on Savoonga, St. Lawrence Island. We're working with Yupik, the community of Savoonga out there, working on just with youth and addressing suicide, Native youth suicide and prevention, and trying to get kids back involved into their culture there. It's such an isolated community, and trying to get kids back in, interested in whaling, carving, and working with their elders. So been out there 3 times shooting, and so working on that film right now.
And editing at this point? Are you to that stage?
We're still in production. So, and the kids, we have a bunch of kids involved, and they actually have cameras doing on video diaries, which was going to be great to incorporate into the film. So, it's a difficult film to make, obviously, because of the location, but it's fascinating.
Do you have an idea of when it'll come out?
No. I'm hoping, you know, we'll probably film for another 12 months, and post will be probably up to 9 months. So
post-production.
You know, post-production, sorry. So about 2 years. You know, the average documentary is usually about 3 years. Funding is an obstacle, then making and editing and distribution. So it's quite a process and a commitment.
Jen, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. Again, Jen's film, The Eskimo and the Whale, will be airing Wednesday night, October 5th at 8 p.m. on 360 North. 360 North will repeat the broadcast Sunday evening, October 9th at 7 p.m., and that can be watched throughout the state wherever 360 North is distributed. Jen, thank you very much. I should ask very quickly, how's the weather in Bend?
82 degrees, I must say. Thanks for having me very much. I appreciate it.
50 and rainy, and thank you very much for coming on.
Take care.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 4th of October, 2011. It was on this date, 1535, the first complete modern English translation of the Bible was printed, the Coverdale Bible, compiled, printed by Miles Coverdale, English priest living on the continent at the time. He would later go on to become Bishop of Exeter. 1883, on this date, the first formal run of the Orient Express. It ran from Paris to Constantinople, was comprised of sleeper cars, Pullman cars, with paneled interiors, leather armchairs, silk sheets, wool blankets. The original train stopped serving Istanbul in 1977, finally ceased operation in 2009, but there still is a train called the Orient Express, which runs from London to a variety of destinations in Europe and uses the restored original cars. It's the birthday of Damon Runyon, born Manhattan, Kansas, 1884. Author of stories about New York lowlife, part New York street slang, part vernacular that he invented himself. It's the birthday of Buster Keaton, born Joseph Frank Keaton, Pequa, Kansas, 1895, to a family of vaudevillians. Parents added him to the act when he was just 3 years old, and he quickly learned that the more serious the expression on his face, the harder the audience would laugh. Made a number of silent film masterpieces in the 20s, The Navigator, The General, The Cameraman. Went through some hard times due to marital troubles, heavy drinking, creative problems at the studio. Was still working in the 1960s and still doing most of his own stunts, almost right up until he died in 1966. It's the birthday of Brendan Gill, born 1914, Hartford, Connecticut, graduated from Yale, and went off to join the staff of The New Yorker in that same year, 1936. Wrote 15 books, biographies, social histories, some fiction, criticism, poetry, and was a devoted supporter of architectural preservation. And it's the birthday of Anne Rice, 1941, born New Orleans, whose first book was Interview with the Vampire, 1976. Raised a Catholic, left the church at 18, returned in the late 90s, began a series of books about the life of Christ, but last summer announced on her Facebook page that she was leaving organized religion behind once again. She wrote, "Today I quit being a Christian. I'm out. I remain committed to Christ as always, but not to being Christian or to being part of Christianity. It's simply impossible for me to belong to this quarrelsome, hostile, disputatious, and deservedly infamous group. I'm an outsider, My conscience will allow nothing else. Here's a poem for today by Marvin Bell, catalog with illustrations. The beauty of an old desk blotter where ink stains grew into the shapes of ships in a turbulent ocean, and the ticking of the clock in the sunlight thickened by dust. The clacking of the typewriter keys, the big zipper sound of the carriage return, and the sound of the struck bell muffled in the drapes. The air was rich with time when there was still time. The letter ripened slowly in the typewriter. The minute hand took a second to move one digit. Under the glass that covered the desktop, a map and family photos. A poem by Marvin Bell, catalog with illustrations from Rampant, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Scheutzker. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 21 minutes after 3. Pat Moore, I'm your guest host today on Juno Afternoon. I have three folks in the studio with me now to talk to us about the Discovery Southeast program, which is primarily offerings for early dismissal on Mondays, but has a lot of other activities going on as well. Beth Weigel is here, the director of the program.
Hi, Pat.
Hiya. Kathleen Balantik, who is program coordinator.
Hi.
And Christine Amor, who is an AmeriCorps volunteer working with the folks at Discovery Southeast.
Hello.
Hi. So, Beth, tell us what this program does and who's involved in it and like that.
Right. Well, last year the school district decided that teachers needed a little bit more planning time, and so they started to do what was called the early dismissal every other Monday, for the most part every other Monday. And it works out that there's about 15 or 16 of these Mondays in a year. So particularly in the elementary school age, the kids are getting done with school at 1:30 in the afternoon, and if you're a working parent, that makes a little bit of a challenge to figure out what to do with your child. And so we came up with this program. We just call it Early Dismissal Mondays, and it basically is available to any of the schools. We have current groups right now in Auk Bay and Harborview and Gastineau Elementary School, and Glacier Valley. I think we have a couple kids at Mendenhall right now. But we have for 2 hours after school on those early dismissal Mondays from 1:30 to 3:30, you can go outside and hike and play games and spend that little bit of extra time that you might not normally get to do outside enjoying nature in all the different seasons that will occur over the course of this next year.
Kathleen, you're the program coordinator, so you dream up the activities for this and then run them? Or?
Well, one of the things that's really neat about this program is we have a different facilitator at each school, a different naturalist at each school who runs it. And so activities really do vary depending on the naturalist and also depending on the site around the school. I know I'm at Gastineau this year, so we like to be within walking distance of the school, so Sandy Beach and then the areas around Treadwell Ditch Trail are kind of where we do our thing, and it really depends on the site, which is part of what makes it fun, I think, for the kids.
So when you say you have a program coordinator at each school, then is it your job to coordinate the coordinators? Is that?
Oh, yeah, I sort of coordinate the naturalists at
okay.
each school, yes.
Okay. So and what does an AmeriCorps volunteer do in this whole scheme of things?
So basically, I'm doing what Kathleen did last year, and I came over here to sort of be an assistant naturalist to one naturalist at Harborview Elementary, for example. But I still lead my Early Dismissal Monday program, so, you know, this naturalist comes along with me, but it's pretty much my planning, and then we take the kids out, and that goes the same for each school, but other than that, I really assist on Discovery Days, which we'll be doing coming up in October, and also just sort of helping with different programming that we do throughout the year. So, yeah.
Right. Our main program that we do at Discovery Southeast is nature studies in all the third, fourth, and fifth grade classes here in four of the elementary schools, actually. And so both Kathleen and Christine work as assistant naturalists in their respective schools. They lead their early dismissal Monday programs every other Monday. And then they both have a hand in planning our Discovery Days, which are another opportunity for parents to have their kids getting outside and experiencing, you know, the fun different trails and nature and things like that in our community on days where there's an in-service, perhaps, where teachers, you know, will have to work, but kids will be off and parents are probably working as well. Some of the holidays that occur, like, for example, the last day of spring break, we do something up at Eagle Crest, and other days that are, you know, maybe parent-teacher conferences or something. So days the kids have off, but parents might still have to work, and, you know, again, what can my kids do that's going to be fun and exciting? So our next Discovery Days happen this month on October 17th and 18th. That's Monday and Tuesday. So they're all day. We provide transportation this time of year still, since the snow hasn't started to fly yet, and we feel confident in our maroon loon, the van that we have.
And so maroon loon.
The maroon loon, yep, that's the name of the van. And so we'll pick kids up either in the valley, probably at Riverbend or at Harborview Elementary School. We could take up to 13 kids on those programs, and they head out in the van and find a cool place to go hiking, and we're hopeful again this year to spend some time out at the Eagle Valley Center on one of those days, and possibly somewhere else that's going to be fun and exciting. But you can always check our website to find out more details as we get closer here to the 17th and 18th.
If I wanted my child to participate in the program,
mm-hmm.
then what would I have to do to make sure they got a ride in the maroon loon?
Well, you just need to register your child. We have registration forms on our website, or give us a call at the office at 463-1500. Christine and Kathleen are there to answer the phone and answer your questions. And you would just, if you were registered for one of those 2 days coming up here, you'd be guaranteed a spot in the maroon loon, and you just have to decide where you wanted to be picked up, downtown or in the valley.
Kathleen, what would you be doing on the Discovery Days? Do you have different duties that you have to perform for that? As the program coordinator?
Well, I might be running one of them as a naturalist. But other than that, it's just figuring out where our hike site is going to be for that day, and also figuring out a warm-up space for each day, like just in case the weather is a little bit rainy or cold.
Like Juneau.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And Kathleen, what will you do when these happen?
I'm going to be assisting on both days, so I'll sort of just be there as another set of hands, as another leader for whatever we're doing.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, I called you Kathleen, you're Christine.
Oh, yeah, no,
it's
okay.
Great. We have these.
It's confusing with two C's.
It is confusing.
Okay.
Yeah, they like to play games. You know, there's a ton of games that they have that they do outside.
Mm-hmm.
They oftentimes will do some fort building. Maybe this year, you know, for the older kids, we might do a little bit of GPS geotracking or something.
Ooh.
Like that. I don't know. We have to talk about our events for these 2 days coming up, but it's usually a great day. Kids get to maybe go to a trail that they don't, you know, get to go to every day because it's not in their neighborhood, so it's a great opportunity to spend some time outside.
How does someone find out what the child needs to bring to the event? I'm assuming they have to, like, pre-pack for school or something like that.
Yeah, so and all the details are on our website, but we want the kids to be as comfortable as they can outside. So that means rain pants, rain jacket, rain boots, just really dressing for the weather. Even a change of clothes is good to have in your backpack. Lunch, a water bottle, a snack. We might sometimes have some warm teas or something like that on hand. But come equipped with your food and your water repellent, warm clothing, and you'll be all set.
When the event's over, how do you get your child back? Where do they come back to?
You pick them up at the school that you dropped them off at. You know?
Okay.
And just a note on that, too, if, you know, we do offer scholarships for all of our programs. So if you're listening and you're thinking, gosh, that sounds like a great time, but I don't think I could afford that, you can, because we do pay as you can and it's part of our scholarship program. And if there is a really limited financial base in your family, then we can certainly talk about a full scholarship. We have great organizations and partners that support that, including the Douglas Dornan Foundation and the PEO. So we appreciate their support for our scholarships that we can provide. And we also have some gear available, too. So if you don't have some rubber boots, we have a couple different pairs that are kid sizes, and we can also track down some other gear if needed as well.
What is the fee structure?
The fee structure, we're a membership organization, so we give our members just a little bit of a discount. So it varies for the different programs. It's on our website, but generally speaking, members are paying a little bit less.
Okay.
I think for a Discovery Day,
it's $35 for a member for a Discovery Day,
and then $40 for
non-members.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then for Early Dismissal Monday, we have a variety of punch cards that you can, you know, choose if you want to do a 3-time come to it or 6 times, or if you did all 15, it comes out to about $10 a day if you're a member, I think.
Oh.
So it's pretty inexpensive.
So you've mentioned this website 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
Can anybody remember the address?
Sure. It's www.discoverysoutheast.org.
DiscoverySoutheast.org, all
yep,
one big
all
word.
All one word, all spelled out, yep.
Okay, and probably Googling Discovery Southeast would get you to the site as well.
Yes, it would. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We've talked with Beth Weigel, with Kathleen Balantik, and Christine Amor about the Discovery Days program. Thank you very much for coming down and talking about this to us.
Thanks.
No, thank you.
It's 3:33. You're in tune with KTOO FM. I'm Pat Moore, guest hosting today on Juno Afternoon, and I have guests in the studio with me. Colette Costas here and Cheryl Levitt, the giggling in the background, and we're going to talk about the Windy Ridge Roundup.
Yes, well, this is a very exciting event that we have kicking off the K&N Concert Series. This is a new series here for us at the station. We thought it would be a really great way to kind of showcase all of the different genres of music that K&N has to offer. So this first concert is highlighting kind of blues, country, folky, not blues, but country, folky field of music. And the next concert we have lined up for December highlights jazz. Our February concert is going to be classical, and Larry West is going to be hosting that. And then, let's see, February, March, April, Grace Elliott is going to be doing something in the blues realm. And then in June, we're looking at a singer-songwriter with Katie Bosler hosting. So, again, it's just a great way to showcase all that K&N has to offer over the air, but also a wonderful way for us to further the interest in local music in town and really support the local musicians and create a really unique and different venue for people to come out and get local music. Our intent with the series is that we are offering people something totally unique in this town when they go to one of these concerts. You're going to get something that you don't get on a typical Friday or Saturday night out. So the audience will come in. We're going to have really nice hors d'oeuvres laid out. This time around, Rainbow Foods is doing some catering. And then we have our MCs this time, Colette and Scott, who are going to create a format of both music and interview and conversation. So, again, you get something kind of behind the scenes and just a whole unique music experience.
Why Windy Ridge?
That's a great question, Scott.
Oh, I'm Pat.
Pat.
It's okay.
No problem. Scott, Pat, Lou, okay. Joe. I don't know the answer.
It sounded fun, Windy Ridge Roundup. I just threw that out there, and I said, that sounds great. I'll go to that.
Awesome. Well, way back in the dark ages of the 70s and 80s, there was a little communal household over here on Main Street, and I don't know where, to be honest. I think it's blown away. But it was actually
very windy up there.
It was a little communal house that a lot of, at that time, neo-hippies were living in, and they would have, God, this new studio is awesome, by the way. They would have these, they would have orgies and potlucks and sometimes potluck orgies.
We won't be recreating all of that tomorrow night.
No, we're not going to be doing a potluck. And they would also have these big music parties. And so when I first came to town, we used to have this little tradition of having these living room music jams and music parties, and they were usually, you know, fairly open to people. And it was a lot of sort of what I referred to then as the old-timers, who were probably like 30 at the time. But they would always talk about Windy Ridge, and it was like this mythical place. And it was, I can't remember who it was, you know, Albert McDonald was there, and Patty, and Betsy Sims, and all these people who are kind of, who at one point were sort of the backbone of the music scene, particularly downtown, I should say that. So for me, it was always a place that was really evocative of communal music experience, which I thought fit in well with the theme of the series in general, but particularly with the one that Scott and I were putting together. And Scott Burton hosts one of the it's one of the porch shows, back porch, front porch, side porch.
Right, K&N at 9 o'clock on Tuesday nights.
Yes, that's the one, which I believe is sort of a ball-headed stepchild of what Don Drew's show was, the Mule Train, years ago. It takes 17 guys to replace Don Drew. You know, that's fine. But that was sort of part of it, too, was, you know, Don Drew had this legacy that these other newcomers, you know, were sort of perpetuating and adding to and changing and continuing. So I thought all those themes sort of worked together on this. And, you know, orgies never hurt. But there will be no orgies at this concert.
But hors d'oeuvres. Sort of sounds like hors d'oeuvres, but hors d'oeuvres, yeah.
There will be hors d'oeuvres and zipper pulls if you bring them. Also, so what we have is an eclectic little lineup of musicians that they're playing tomorrow. From each of them, sort of, I think, is in a particular genre, but they all can play within other genres as well. So you have, you know, Andy Ferguson, who is, you know, usually, you know, he does a lot of Irish tunes. He also does a lot of old-timey stuff. He does a lot of, you know, what I call that kind of early crossover stuff. you know, Jack Fontenelle, God knows what Jack Fontenelle plays. I mean, I can't even imagine it. But he's good, so they tell me. But he'll, you know, Eric Chadwell, he used to be in the Crabgrass Panhandle Revival Band, which was a form of bluegrass, if you will. And he plays other things now. He also plays jazz, plays clarinet. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Now you do. We have Aaron Hansen, who is going to be doing some country songs, some more on the girly side of country. I think she's doing some Loretta Lynn songs. Pat Henry will be there, who is our own version. He's like a white Texas version of Matt Lipscomb. So he's more in sort of the Texas blues sound. He can also play almost anything, but it all sounds awesomely like Pat Henry playing Texas blues. So I've asked him, there's this one song, he does this Mose Allison cover of Little Red Wagon that you swear was written in like 1927, which I love. So we got that going on. I'll be singing a couple with Riley Woodford, who's going to be covering more of the contemporary singer-songwriter stuff. Stuart Flash, who used to be one of the hosts of these big music parties back when he was at on 6th Street there. Stuart's going to be there doing whatever the kind of magic that he does. And he also does odd jobs for hire. So
there you go. Got a handyman and a great concert.
He's quite a handyman. who else is there? I feel like I'm going to slight someone if I forget them, but they know that.
Brooke Monroe.
Brooke will be there, of course. She'll be playing the bass for a number of people. Oh, and Sergey will also be there. I think he's going to cover kind of a little bit of a Cajun beat. He's going to be backing some other people up, but I think you be forewarned, everyone. I'm pretty sure he's going to bring an accordion. You know, it won't hurt unless he actually throws it at you. So that's fine. And there will be banjos. Sorry. Not my fault. Anyway, yeah, I think there's about 9 or 10 of us.
This little hootenanny starts again, what time?
It starts at 7 p.m. and we'll go till about 9. And again, I just want to emphasize, like, what you can expect when you go there is a totally fun and great time.
Yeah.
I mean, what Colette just reeled off here is a ton of really accomplished, fun musicians. Everybody's really excited to do this show. There's going to be snacks, again, provided by Rainbow Foods. So just come in, expect to just come in, be well-treated, sit down and have a totally unique music experience. And tickets you can get in advance online until noon tomorrow, and after that we're going to sell them at the door. They're $10 in advance at krnn.org, or at the door they're $12. Kids under 12 can get in for $5, and I will tell you that half the tickets are gone. It's a small space. We've already got 40 of them handed out to people, so if you want in on this, don't wait. Go to krnn.org and get your ticket.
And it's where?
Gold Town Theater.
The right. Gold Town Nickelodeon, right downtown in the Emporium building, the best kept secret in Juneau. Which is also known as Behind City Hall.
There you go.
That's our address is Behind City Hall.
And fire up the popcorn machine.
Of course.
And cushions as you come in the door.
We have better cushions now.
And if you get in real early, you can get the couches in the back.
Yeah, there you go. And we won't go there. Okay.
I have.
Okay, well, an amazing-sounding event. Is this going to be like 15-minute sets? Is it going to be reminiscent of...
It's going to be a lot more open than that. I mean, definitely, like, you know, I'll be doing a song here and a song there, but... and there'll be certain little setups. You know, I don't want to call them bands or groups, but the idea is that there's a core of people doing a particular song or a set of songs, but the other people on stage are welcome to play along with them, as long as they don't train wreck the whole thing, which is why I'm not allowed to sing harmony on any of them. But that's fine. But the idea is that it's going to be, you know, it's well practiced and rehearsed, so it's a polished show, but it's relaxed enough that it's as if you were, you know, in someone's living room, you know.
If someone managed to get themselves booked tomorrow night and can't make it, when's the next one?
The next one is going to be on December 7th, and that's Robert Sewell's doing a night that's dedicated to jazz. He has a couple ideas in mind and has started to connect with a few different musicians, but we don't have the exact show ready to unveil at the moment. But that's going to be great. Robert Sewell's a really great host, and he has already has good experience around town hosting not open mic nights, but nights where he does interview and conversations with jazz musicians. So this will be similar to that. And again, in February, I think it's February 8th, is Larry West doing classical music. So three plans so far. No, actually, then the fourth one again is in April. That's going to be the first week in April, right before the Folk Fest. That's Grace Elliott, and she's working on a blues-inspired evening. And then in June, that first week in June, that first Wednesday, is Katie Bosler working with a singer-songwriter.
All five in the same venue?
Yep, mm-hmm. All at the Gold Town, all part of the same KRNN concert series. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Since there are going to be snacks there, we didn't really talk about this, but we're starting this at 7, but since there's food there, I know how Juno is. You're going to get there at 7. Y'all come for movies at 7:05 that start at 7. Don't get there at 7 and think you're going to sit around and eat food. Get there at 6:40 or 6:50 and have some snacks and visit with your friends so you can take a seat at 7:05-ish so we can play music and et cetera, et cetera.
Tomorrow night, 7 at the Gold Town, Windy Ridge Roundup.
Well, she's there at the bar every evening. Face powder, cheek paint red. Her beauty has faded.
Music there from the Great Alaska Bluegrass Band, getting us all ready for Colette Costa and Cheryl Levitt hosting the Windy Ridge Roundup tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. It's 3:48 at KTOO. Tonight they're calling for mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. The low's around 38. The east winds will stay with about 10 miles per hour, and they'll become light and variable late. Tomorrow we're looking at the same, mostly cloudy, scattered rain showers, highs around 50, and light winds.
This is Bird Note. What is that cloud, low in the autumn sky, shape-shifting as you watch from a beach or mudflat, suddenly flashing from dark to light? It's a cloud of small sandpipers called dunlins. When threatened by a falcon, for instance, dunlins take to the air, flying so close together that it's hard for a predator to capture one. The dunlin's synchronous twisting and turning is a marvel of aerial acrobatics, with the birds alternately flashing brown backs and white bellies. The speed of change is breathtaking, with hundreds of birds turning simultaneously. A researcher, curious about the lack of mid-air collisions and speculating about extrasensory communication, filmed a few of these flocks. He found that a bird at one edge turns toward the middle and a wave sweeps across the entire flock in less than a second. Like a member of a chorus line, each bird sees the movement beginning to happen and makes the appropriate response. To see that chorus line of dunlin, begin at our website, birdnote.org. Also, sign up for the podcast or weekly preview mail. That's birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
ka hai koe e hano tau ho ringa wa lea ka hai e lea mai koe ko he mea le le
by the South Pacific group Te Waka. They'll be appearing in Juneau on October 16th at JDHS, concert starting at 7 p.m. It's 5 minutes before 4 o'clock.
Tonight on 360 North, at 8 o'clock, explore the strength and courage of the Inupiat people struggling to preserve their subsistence whaling culture in the Arctic regions of Alaska through the documentary The Eskimo and the Whale. That's followed at 9 by Lords of Nature, Life in a Land of Great Predators. Then at 10, watch the Public Affairs series Miller Center Forum. It's a great way to look at Alaska and the world, tonight on 360 North.
I am scared of you.
I am scared of you.
I am scared of you.
I am a leader.
Volunteer.
I give back to my community.
Culture, science, business, faith.
I am scared of you.
I am scared of you.
Here's my story.
Here are our stories.
So these are the blades in the design that you can see that.
Here, Nate Malone explains the ins and outs of the wind turbine he and his classmates at Haynes High School recently designed and submitted in a statewide competition. The Haynes team took first place in Alaska's Kid Wind contest. Kid Wind is a national competition that challenges teenagers to research, design, construct, and then test their own wind turbine designs. It's a chance for kids to immerse themselves in all the aspects and hands-on science behind creating a viable alternative energy system that's judged both on its efficiency and its elegance. Hunter Badgley is a senior in the class.
I wasn't exactly sure what I was getting into, and it's been a pleasant surprise, everything that we've been learning and getting to build, and just a lot of hands-on experience that most people probably don't get to have in their high school career.
Mark Fontenot is the Power Systems and Engineering Science class teacher and the advisor to the Haynes group.
Every school had to build their own prototype turbine, and then they traveled to all the schools that were in and tested them for how much power they could, or how much energy they could produce in 60 seconds in a little kind of a model, like a wind tunnel setup. 65% of the score was based on the power output, and the other 35% was based on sort of how you documented the process and how we could illustrate that we really did some engineering and some R&D.
Second place for the Alaska Kid Wind competition went to the school in Noatak. I'm Shanna Sheehy.
I am a teenager.
I am an Alaskan. I give back.
Do you see me?
Recognize youth, ages 12 to 19, at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Association of Alaska School Boards, Initiative for Community Engagement.
Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, we'll talk with author P.T. Custard about her new children's book, The Crowded Backyard. That'll be prior to Friday's book signing at Hearthside Books downtown. Hera Magazarian and Jed Hancock-Brainerd will be here to talk about their roles in Perseverance Theater's production of The 39 Steps. We'll highlight First Friday activities in the Senate building with Anne House of Boehm, Alana Balam-Schwan of Figment, and Mark Vinsel of the Juno Artists Gallery. And we'll get a preview of Wednesday's Wildlife Wednesday program featuring Ernestine Hayes. We'll also hear Writer's Almanac, music, and more tomorrow at 3 on Juno Afternoon.
Birds that warble them.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon Creek and Switzer Creek, K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens to us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau, Digital Channel 871. Our sister station KRNN is at Digital Channel 872.
Monetary policy can be a powerful tool, but it is not a panacea for the problems currently facing the U.S. economy.
Ben Bernanke tells Congress the recovery has been weaker than expected.
It's Tuesday, October 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Guy Raz. Coming up, the Fed Chair's message on Capitol Hill.
Also, the circles of influence behind an effort to help major corporations secure a big tax break.
This year's Nobel Prize for Physics honors scientists who study the expansion of the universe.
The origins of the universe could be illuminated through a powerful telescope in Chile.
The further back we look, the closer to the beginning of the universe we get. We can see how galaxies are formed, how they evolve, and how they eventually turn into the kinds of galaxies that we see around us today.
And Jackie Gleason and the Honeymooners on DVD.
Those stories coming up. First, this news.